pivot to Asia policy shifted the Pentagon's planning from the Muslim world to China. Biden has continued with an openly antagonistic approach, which rejects Beijing's call for cooperation amid the multiple global crises.
I just think there's so much opposition to cooperation and so much support for a new Cold War that even if Biden wanted to cooperate with China, he couldn't. Like, Trump wanted a peace deal with North Korea, a much less, like, strategic threat to the United States, and Trump wasn't able to get that through.
The talks concluded without the issuance of a final joint statement. Experts in both nations say few should expect a significant improvement in bilateral relations between the two superpowers. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we want it to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food.
I came back to Kashmir like 7 years before. I noticed I was always intrigued by the cultural similarities we have with the Persian community, or per se like the Iranian community, or with Iran. So I noticed those similarities, and I dwelled in the history and in the books of, like, you know, of a tradition, and then I got to know, like, you know, we were one of the tribes that actually came from there, and then we settled here. So our culture is like majorly influenced and pretty much originates from that part of the world.
Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The 6th of Shaban is the title of the latest retaliatory attack carried out by the Yemeni army against one of Aramco oil sites in the Saudi capital Riyadh using drones. The Yemeni army says the operation comes in response to the Saudi continued deadly aggression.
The Yemeni army will continue its strategic operations deep inside Saudi Arabia until the sources of oil dry up. And Aramco, the source of Saudi economy, is destroyed. We will force the Saudi enemy to realize the reality of our capabilities. These operations will continue until the war is stopped and the blockade imposed on our country is lifted.
The Saudi regime confirmed the attack, saying it has caused a fire in the oil refinery in Riyadh and it was controlled. Observers say the Yemeni army should continue such attacks to deal heavy damage to the Saudi economy.
These operations will not have an impact unless the oil facilities are continuously attacked. The oil is the lifeline of the Saudi economy, and Saudi Arabia is using oil money to buy mercenaries and weapons. So these operations must not stop.
For 6 years now, Yemenis have been under a devastating war imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies that caused the death of tens of thousands of people, many of them are women and children. Riyadh has also forced an all-out blockade on Yemen, which has caused more deaths than weapons had.
Yemenis say their army has the right to continue targeting Saudi facilities until Riyadh stops its years-long war and siege against them and releases the illegally detained oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees. A scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed, and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants Indian citizenship to Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Sikhs and other minorities who fled neighboring countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan before 2014, fearing religious persecution. However, the Citizenship Amendment Act discriminates against Muslims and violates the rights of equality enshrined in the Constitution of India. In the state of Assam, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh have long been a source of concern for India. Accordingly, around 2 million residents were left off the National Citizenship Register, a majority of them Muslims. The register is a list of people who can prove they had entered India by March 1971, right before neighboring Bangladesh became an independent country. Analysts say the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party aims at transforming India into a majoritarian community by granting citizenship rights to majority groups. And all this has dented India's democratic image globally and has downgraded India from a democracy to an electoral autocracy. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination center, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels city. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
I have a vaccination center behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me, for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment.
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and underdelivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
This is a safe and effective vaccine.
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland. Many hospitals are reaching breaking point. Health experts warn that when centres are not being fully utilised, COVID-19 mutations are allowed to develop in the community. The big concern is future variants might be even more contagious and more deadly. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon is fighting for her political life. An inquiry into her handling of the sexual harassment charges brought against her predecessor Alex Salmond is underway. Salmond and Sturgeon have both given evidence, but a leaked draft report has revealed committee members have voted 5-4 that Sturgeon gave them an inaccurate account of what happened. However, she says she stands by every word.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee, all 8 hours worth of evidence. I mean, what's been clear is the opposition members of this committee made their minds up about me before I uttered a single word of evidence. Their public comments have made that clear. So this leak from the committee, very partisan leak tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report. But more importantly, the question of whether or not I breached the ministerial code is being considered independently by James Hamilton QC, and I hope and expect to receive and publish that report soon.
If that inquiry also finds against her, she is not legally compelled to resign, but she'll be under a lot of pressure to do so. A recent poll shows her party have a 22-point lead, so she may well remain First Minister after the May elections. What's certain is Sturgeon isn't going down without a fight. In the evidence she gave earlier this month, she defended her position, accused Salmond of inappropriate behaviour, and apologised directly to the two women that were let down by the government investigation.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants.
Alex Salmond was cleared of all charges and compensated for his legal fees, but now Sturgeon is on the ropes. Many are questioning why a new policy on sexual harassment, inspired by the Me Too movement, could be used to bring down the First Minister, a woman herself and one of the most successful politicians of a generation. Analysts say one reason might be that she is also the figurehead of Scotland's independence campaigners. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature.
Mitsubishi Corporation, its Japanese engineering affiliate, Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Scott Foster, an analyst with Lightstream Research Tokyo, entitled Japan Incorporation Driving Towards the Hydrogen Energy Future. The article was published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. When Warren Buffett's investment company, Berkshire Hathaway, announced last August that it had acquired more than 5% of the five largest Japanese general trading companies, including Mitsubishi Corporation, Itochu, Mitsui & Co., Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corporation, most failed to notice that Buffett was buying into coal-fired power projects. Within 3 months, a group of institutional investors led by Nordi Asset Management of Finland sent a letter to Mitsubishi Corporation requesting that it abandon its Vang Ang 2 coal-fired power plant project in Vietnam. Friends of the Earth, Greta Thunberg, and Japanese environmentalists piled on, but to no avail. However, in February, Mitsubishi Corporation announced its withdrawal from the Vinh Thanh 3 coal-fired power plant project, also in Vietnam, and said that Vang Ong 2 would be its last such project. Both Itochu and Mitsui & Co. have also announced plans to exit thermal coal. Marubeni and Sumitomo Corp. plan to do so except in cases when no other source of power is available and where the most advanced emission reduction technologies are used. So, what will they do instead? These are large companies with annual turnover ranging from $48 billion to $146 billion before and presumably after the COVID-19 pandemic. Operating in a wide range of businesses from resources and energy to infrastructure, industry, IT and finance, they have no shortage of projects. And they're all involved in hydrogen energy. For example, Mitsubishi Corp., its Japanese engineering affiliate Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. Itochu plans to build one of the world's largest liquid hydrogen plants in Japan with Air Liquide to supply fuel cell vehicles. Air Liquide already operates hydrogen fueling stations in Japan. Mitsui & Co. has entered into an agreement with Hiringa Energy to pursue commercial hydrogen energy projects in New Zealand. It has also invested $25 million in First Element Fuel, the largest developer and operator of hydrogen stations in California. Marubeni is working with Siemens and Master to develop hydrogen and other alternative energy technologies in Abu Dhabi. Sumitomo Corp. and Japanese engineering company JGC are planning to build a facility in Australia that would produce hydrogen using solar-powered electrolysis. These and many other Japanese companies are also getting involved in hydrogen energy through consortia and industry associations. Recently, the Hydrogen Energy Supply Chain, HECS, pilot project in Victoria, Australia, announced that the world's first coal-to-hydrogen production process had begun operations. The HESC project is being implemented by a consortium, including from Japan, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, J-Power, Gas Distributor, Iwatani, Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corp., supported by the Victorian, Australian, and Japanese governments. Last October, the Japan Hydrogen Association was established by Mitsui & Co., Iwatani, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, Japanese Oil and Energy Company, ENEOS, Coop Steel, Mitsui Financial Group, Kansai Electric Power, and Toshiba. It aims to form international alliances and develop global hydrogen supply chains. In December, those companies were joined by Toyota and shipping company K-Line. In addition, K-Line, Iwatani, Kansai Electric Power, Nomura Shipbuilding, the Development Bank of Japan, and Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology have formed a group to promote hydrogen fuel cell-powered ships. Marubeni is also leading the COP Kansai Hydrogen Utilization Council, which aims to develop a regional hydrogen supply chain in west-central Japan. The council includes many of the companies listed above, plus power plant equipment maker Mitsubishi Power, general contractor Obayashi, and Shell Japan. The Japanese are keen on industry associations, which often overlap. It sounds bureaucratic, but ensures a degree of coordination that would be hard to achieve otherwise, as well as logistical and financial support for worldwide operations. Iwatani recently announced plans to produce hydrogen with Stanwell Corporations in Queensland, Australia, and to build 7 new hydrogen fueling stations in California with Toyota. With interest high in Toyota's latest developments in hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles, it's worth pointing out that Honda and Nissan also make hydrogen FCEVs. Toyota began financing the construction of hydrogen fueling stations for passenger cars and other vehicles in California in 2014. Honda quickly followed suit. Toyota, Honda, and Nissan have been supporting the development of hydrogen station infrastructure in Japan since 2015. ENEOS now plans to install hydrogen pumps at its gas stations, a first for Japan and one that points toward a nationwide build-out. ENEOS operates some 13,000 service stations from Hokkaido to Okinawa. Available data show that there are now some 135 hydrogen fueling stations in Japan, 150-plus in Europe, more than half of them in Germany, about 80 in North America, more than half of them in California, and more than 70 in China. The list of hydrogen power applications continues to grow. Buses powered by Toyota hydrogen fuel cells are being introduced in Japan and Portugal. East Japan Railway Company, Hitachi, and Toyota are working on train engines powered by hydrogen fuel cells and storage batteries, and construction equipment maker Komatsu plans to develop hydrogen-powered mining trucks. There are questions about hydrogen energy, most of them having to do with its relatively high cost, how it can be transported efficiently and safely, and the potentially negative environmental consequences of hydrogen production. All of these problems are currently the subject of research and feasibility studies. Hydrogen fuel is currently several times more expensive than gasoline, but the price should come down as the volume produced and sold goes up, which will happen as Japan moves from 135 hydrogen stations now to several thousands in ENEOS network alone. Transport is made economical by liquefaction and compression. Scott Foster wrote, "As with gasoline, safety is a matter of pipe, tank, and fueling system engineering." At one trade show I attended in the United States, an industry representative explained that this company's hydrogen fuel tank could withstand an attack by 50-caliber machine gun. Hidden environmental costs are a concern with most, if not all, alternatives to fossil fuels. In the case of hydrogen, the issues getting the most attention are the source of energy for electrolysis and potential carbon emissions from the coal to hydrogen production process. The former is easily monitored. The latter will either be dealt with efficiently or the technology will fail economically as well as politically. As for competition, KMPG's Global Automotive Executive Survey of 2017 found that 78% of 1,000 senior auto executives thought that hydrogen FCEVs would eventually outperform battery-powered EVs. Elon Musk is not one of them, but Toyota, Honda, and Nissan are pursuing both battery and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Some industry observers believe that the cost of new technology and infrastructure will prove to be too high, but both government support and the long, but incomplete list of companies mentioned in this article suggest otherwise. In any case, Warren Buffett investments have done well so far. As of March 12th, the share prices of Japan's 5 biggest trading companies were up 45% to 99% from their 52-week lows.
Debate. Saudi Arabia has proposed a peace plan to end the years-long war it started on Yemen. The move follows an escalation in drone and missile attacks by the Yemeni army on crucial Saudi infrastructure, including airports, oil facilities, and getting closer to the capital, Riyadh. The Yemenis don't seem eager to accept the proposal, as they have set their own conditions for a peace initiative. In this edition of the debate, we will shed light on the different aspects of the Saudi proposal and the reason why the Yemenis are not gasping for it.
Saudi Arabia has tabled what it calls a comprehensive peace initiative to end the war it waged on Yemen 6 years ago. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud said talks to end the war should be held between Ansarullah and the Riyadh-backed forces of former Yemeni President Abdul Rabu Mansur Hadi.
We announced the kingdom's initiative to end the Yemeni crisis and reach a comprehensive solution. The initiative includes a United Nations-sponsored ceasefire. The kingdom calls on the Yemeni government and the Houthis to accept the initiative.
The initiative also proposes the reopening of Sana'a Airport, but Ansarullah is skeptical. It insists the talks between Yemenis will only materialize if Saudi Arabia stops its interference, noting that Riyadh itself is part of the problem. The movement says Saudis should end the blockade on all key entry points into Yemen.
If the humanitarian steps are taken, as well as the reopening of Sana'a Airport, the unconditional reopening of Hodeidah Port, then this indicates that there is a serious desire to have a dialogue on the military and political operations. As for the initiatives only, these are not serious.
Ansarullah's chief negotiator in the UN-brokered talks, Mohammed Abdus Salam, earlier said the Saudi-proposed initiative offers nothing new. He said Riyadh is using Yemeni's humanitarian rights as a means of pressure by maintaining the blockade on the country, which he said is unacceptable. That points to what Ansarullah has always said about the Saudi-proposed peace initiatives. The movement says they are stunts to secure Riyadh's own interests. Saudi-led forces have, time and again, breached UN-brokered ceasefires, with Ansarullah by even conducting airstrikes on the so-called neutral zone. The latest such attack was just days ago when Saudi warplanes hit a grains depot in Salaf port, in violation of a 2018 deal that designates the port a neutral zone. Saudi's acts of aggression and blockade have drawn retaliatory attacks from the Yemeni army and Ansarullah. On Tuesday, Yemeni forces carried out an airstrike on Abha International Airport in southern Saudi Arabia. It came a few days after a drone attack that targeted a Saudi Aramco oil facility near the capital, Riyadh. Ansarullah also targeted Riyadh with a ballistic missile nearly a month ago. Riyadh and its critical infrastructure coming under attack has dramatically upped the ante for Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war they stage on their neighboring country. Riyadh appears to be searching for a face-saving way out without having to offer any concession. But that is a non-starter for Yemeni forces, who have gradually managed to shift the momentum in the war that Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed on them.
To discuss that further, we're joined by lawyer and human rights activist Kim Sharif out of London, and also director of IGA Ali Al Ahmad out of Washington, D.C. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Kim Sharif from London. Now, the Saudi proposal comes at a time of increasing attacks on its crucial infrastructure, and while U.S. President Joe Biden has called for an end to the Saudi-led aggression, although no concrete measures have been taken so far in that regard, how genuine is the Saudi peace plan?
Good evening to you, and thank you for the invite to join you in this program. That's absolutely not serious enough, because it's clearly flavored with malafides, bad intention, because if they really wanted to stop the aggression on Yemen, there's nothing to stop them from stopping it. All they have to do is wave the white flag. But what they're doing instead is they're just tiptoeing around the issue of continuing to pretend that this is a civil war and that Saudi Arabia is a bona fide peace broker, when it cannot be that. Saudi Arabia is a leading member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been pounding Yemen for the past 6 years to smithereen, quite frequently, in fact, almost always, targeting civilian places. As recently as this week, they have targeted a hemp farm in Al Amran area. They've targeted another factory. So Saudi Arabia is not a bona fide peace broker for it to be making a proposal. That's one thing. The second, Saudi Arabia is an aggressing party. It is an enemy. It is a party that is guilty of the serious crime of aggression against the state of Yemen. And this proposal is yet another attempt at misleading the world into thinking that it is now trying to sort it out. What it doesn't want to admit is the fact that it has been defeated spectacularly. After 6 years of its world support and Western support, I'm talking about here, world support, Western support, with arms, politics, diplomacy, every known force to mankind today under the sun has been used against the Yemen in order to occupy the Yemen and control its destiny. But they failed miserably, despite the limited resources of the people of Yemen and its government in Sana'a, have managed not only to defend themselves, to defend the country against this aggression beautifully, but also they've now turned the table the other way insofar as they are attacking the heart of the Saudi infrastructure, as your reporter has quite rightly pointed out. So they have been defeated. That's what they are trying to avoid having to admit. And the more they continue their aggression, the more the Yemen will be producing its own weapons, the more the Yemen will be fully entitled to defend itself. An eye for an eye is the only law that applies here, because international rules of law have been disregarded, disrespected, and not complied with by Saudi-led coalition and its Western backers. So the Yemenis are left with nothing but to defend themselves, and yes, they are entitled to do what they are doing, and they must continue their legendary fortitude of 6 years under the world's worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe is simply amazing, and we have much respect for the leaders of the Yemeni government in Sana'a, and we hope them all the best.
Well, thank you very much, Kim Sharif. Let's move on to Ali Al Ahmad from Washington, D.C. Now, as Kim very correctly pointed out, and Ansarullah Movement has also mentioned, that the Saudi Arabia is actually part of the problem, not the solution. So do you believe that the Saudis are actually just using this as a strategy to buy time, because they're exhausted by a war that they did not expect would last so long?
This appears, I agree with Kim, that this is not a serious offer, and it is not designed to end the war, even if the Yemeni side said, okay, go, everybody goes home and repair their car, as we say. This is part of an agreement between the Saudis and the Biden administration to give the appearance that Saudi Arabia wants peace, and the only people who are standing who want war are the Yemenis who are fighting the Saudi and their foreign backed bombing blitz of Yemen for 6 years. You saw how the British, the English dominated British government came up with basically very nasty statement calling on the Yemeni and using pejorative language against the Yemeni people to call on them to accept the Saudi initiative, which was created for they came up with it in consultation with Washington and London, the two major foreign powers that are backing this bombing campaign for 6 years. So this is part of a larger plan to do something else in the UN Security Council. They are trying to cook up another resolution that will absolve all those people who have committed war crimes in Yemen, be it from Washington or London, Riyadh or Abu Dhabi, in Sudan, in Morocco, and all those, and Jordan, and all those who bombed Yemen and destroyed and killed thousands. They are trying to create another UN Security Council, and in preparation for that, they are coming up with this initiative so to isolate the Yemeni forces that are fighting against this invasion. And so this is not a serious offer, and it's just the first step of a campaign, of a political campaign to isolate and to delegitimize the coming power in Yemen. That is those Yemenis who are fighting against the invasion.
Well, thank you very much. Now back to Kim. Well, of course, you have both mentioned that this is not a serious offer, but we do know that since Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war on Yemen back in 2015, several peace initiatives have failed. Why did these initiatives fail to be acceptable to the Ansarullah movement?
Well, they never came forward with any realistic resolution for the problem, insofar as we have said time and again from the beginning of this scenario, this is an act of aggression by Saudi-led coalition backed by the US and the UK and France, no less. This is not a civil war. That's one thing that really needs to be clearly borne in mind, simply because all the parties on the ground that are facing or fighting with Sana'a government are allied to Saudi-led coalition, who get paid, the least paid of them gets $100,000 per annum. Saudi coalition, Saudi regime, from time to time, leaks the lists of the people who get paid by them to continue this war. And this leakage is often designed to entice others to join their ranks. But of course, they failed miserably because all they have is the same old Aqab and Daesh and their political wing, Aslah Party, the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, with them in Riyadh hotels and Cairo hotels and Istanbul hotels, none other than that. So every attempt at trying to resolve the situation in Yemen wasn't a bona fide effort or attempt or desire to bring an end to the conflict, but it was just another sedative mechanism to make the world think that the international community are trying to resolve the situation, when the truth is there was no problem in Yemen, as was clearly declared by the then envoy to the UN, Mr. Jamal Ben Omar, in a recent long article in Newsweek, where he explained that all the parties in Yemen were in agreement under the peace and cooperation agreement after the national dialogue, and the Saudi-led coalition intervention came in on the 26th of March 2015 to frustrate that agreement. The Saudis and their backers didn't want peace in Yemen. They wanted to turn Yemen into another lawless, disintegrated, divided nation, as they did with Somalia previously. But luckily for Yemen, there was leadership consisting of variety of political parties, not just Ansarullah, in association with Ansarullah, in partnership with Ansarullah. They managed to defend the country and unite the people. 80% of the people are under their leadership in Sana'a, IDPs, and they are protected, and the majority of the people of Yemen support this government. And so previous peace agreements couldn't work and wouldn't work simply because it was just another pack of lies, to be honest with you. Just another pack of lies, much like the lie about enforcing Resolution 2216. We all know Resolution 2216 was passed some 3 weeks after the start of the Saudi-led coalition aggression on Yemen. A kind of like, you can never have a UN Security Council instrument that retrospectively authorizes use of force against any nation. And so Resolution 2216 doesn't actually authorize use of force. So, and in any event, it doesn't cover the whole of Yemen. It only affects few named people. Therefore, there can be no comprehensive peace in Yemen whilst the Saudi-led coalition continues its aggression on Yemen and continue to pretend to the world that this is a civil war when it isn't a civil war. Those people who are referring, they are referring to as the legitimate government is also another lie. They all know the former president had his term had ended with the end of the Gulf Initiative in February 2014. So to say it is a legitimate government is a blatant, disgraceful lie. These people are unethical. These people have no respect to the rule of law. These people have no respect to humanity. They've created the worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe under a serious pack of lies, and they're continuing to do the same thing in the hope that perhaps suddenly the Yemenis will just give up on their integrity and their right to self-determination and their right to protect their sovereignty against the invasion of Saudi-led coalition. But that
Thank
is not going
much.
To happen. 6 years on, we're moving on.
Thank you very much, Kim. Let's go back to Ali Ala Ahmad. So, Ali Ala Ahmad, considering what she just said, what are the necessary steps for a political process in order to end the war? And is it even possible as long as the Saudis are involved?
The Saudis' involvement is designed to stop the Yemenis from making peace among themselves. The Saudi government and its foreign backers do not want to see the Yemenis own their own destiny. They don't want to see Yemenis take advantage of their natural resources, their location, and to have independent policies. They want to see Yemen as basically the beggar and the poorer and the backward country that they wish it to see. They don't want to see it powerful and independent. Some Yemenis have sold that right to for others, but most Yemeni people would want to see Yemen that is independent, that is part of the Yemeni culture, in fact, and enable that country to move forward on its own without hegemony from Saudi Arabia or other countries. The political solution has to be left to the Yemenis, and I wouldn't even want the UN to get involved, because we have seen one time after another that the United Nations is nothing but a tool in the hand of bigger states and powerful states to undermine the rights of people, especially in our region, and to deprive them from their basic rights and from poisoning their political future. Really, here it is upon the Yemenis, all of them, even those who are siding with the Saudi invasion, to think that this is time for them to come together and build their own country without foreign intervention from the Saudis or the Americans or the British. This is the time for the Yemenis to rise, and I hope they do it. And they can do it. They have proven that they can forgive each other. It's important, however, to realize that those countries, every country, every government, every regime that has helped bomb and kill Yemenis must pay reparation for the Yemeni people. And I hope the Yemeni parties would start talking about reparation. If the Saudis must pay, the Emiratis, the Al-Khalifas, the Sudanese, the Jordanians, the Americans, the British, the French, the Canadian, the Germans, the Spaniards, and the Italians, everyone who spent a single bullet and helped the Saudi and Emirati bomb Yemen, they must pay for the Yemeni people because we have millions of victims, and that's the least they can do beside admitting their mistake. you notice one thing here, that every all these foreign backers of Saudi and invasion of Yemen are not willing to disclose the extent of their involvement in the war, because they know themselves that they are committing a crime.
Thank you very much, Mr. Al-Ahmad, and also Ms. Kim Sharif. This question is addressed to both of you. The Saudi plan calls for depositing taxes and customs revenue from ships carrying oil to Hodeidah port into a joint account of the central bank, and a limited opening of Sana'a International Airport. This raises questions about what exactly the Saudis are looking for. And Mr. Ahmad, you did mention that the Saudis do not want the Yemenis to be able to exploit their own natural resources. Mr. Al-Ahmad, your comments, please.
I think it's very repugnant for Saudi Arabia to dictate to the Yemenis where they put and deposit their revenues and who should share what. This is not their place. They have no right. The Saudis will not accept if a Yemeni official says the Saudis must do this and do that in their own country. Yemen is independent and should remain independent from anybody, no matter who they are, be the Saudis, the Americans, or the English, or whatever country you're talking about. The Yemeni future must belong to the hand of Yemenis, and they can work there. Their problems themselves. They are not children, and they are not unable. The Yemen people are very capable, and they can figure their problems themselves.
Thank you.
Very important to realize the Saudi regime has no love for the Yemeni people.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Kim Sharif out of London, we have less than 2 minutes. If you could please wrap up your thoughts regarding this final question.
I totally agree. Everything said by Mr. Al-Ahmad, he hit the nail on the head when he said that the Saudis are in no position to dictate to the people of Yemen. They are holding 14 ships carrying essential food, oil derivatives, and medicines unlawfully, arbitrarily, to starve the people of Yemen. And then they turn around and say, oh, we are prepared to do this. And they're closing the Sana'a airport unlawfully in breach of the sovereignty of the state of Yemen. And they turn around and say they will limit the use. Is they not in a position to dictate to Yemen? Quite rightly. Out of Yemen's case, end of story, Yemen is not a back garden for you. The Saudi regime needs to recognize that. Otherwise, it is risking of its own collapse, because Yemenis will not give up their right to defend their sovereignty and to have the right to decide their destiny and their future. They will not give it up. 6 years on, we are producing our own weapons. 6 years on, we are now making them kneel down. And so this pathetic little show of attempts to try and resolve the matter and this dictation isn't going to work. We are free people, and we shall remain free people, and those who invaded us will pay very, very heavily for what they have done, here and hereafter, no doubt. And yes, we will be demanding compensation from every country that has been involved in the aggression on Yemen. And yes, we will not ask for the UN to be involved in this, not Britain or the US, because they are a party to the conflict. They are the ones who facilitated the worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands are still dying per annum, mainly children, 50,000 of them per annum.
I'm very sorry, Ms. Kim Sharif. That's all the time that we have. Lawyer and human rights activist Kim Sharif out of London, and also Ali Al-Ahmad, director of IGA out of Washington, D.C. Thanks to both of you for joining us on this edition of The Debate, and thanks to all of you for following us.